I'm really interested to explore with Josh Mosservi, who is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, on a recent article that he put together. And I'll tell you why. Some years ago, I was on a board of directors, and there were some directors really acting inappropriately, to put it mildly. And our legal counsel got hold of them and said, okay, carry on, but I will be suing each of you in a private capacity. And suddenly, they started acting reasonably. Josh is suggesting something similar for leading lights in the ANC after the insanity that we've been seeing in foreign relations of late. So it'll be interesting to find out from him where he got the idea. Josh, thanks for joining us. It's been, quite difficult to put all of this together. You being in the US, we here in South Africa, time differences. But my goodness, that article that you wrote for the Hudson Institute is pretty hard-hitting. Before we go there, though, just tell us a little about the Hudson Institute and what it is that you do there.
Yeah, sure. And thanks for chatting, Alec. So Hudson Institute is a think tank in Washington, D.C., I think in the American context, think tanks play a somewhat unique role, different than perhaps they play in some other countries. First, there's a lot of them, but they are part of the sort of policy making ecosystem in Washington, D.C. They're not governmental. Most are not governmental. They're non-governmental, but there's a lot of interchange between, American think tanks and the government. So Hudson was founded, maybe 50 or 60 years ago, initially as a founded by futurists. So people who thought, big thoughts about going into 50, 100 years in the future, sort of grand strategists. We do a little bit of that, but not as much. Now we're a conservative think tank. I usually describe us as sort of a Reaganite think tank that is focused on foreign policy and that believes that the world is safer and more prosperous when the U.S. is the unchallenged economic and military power.
And you have got a lot of people and a lot of heavyweights working there, including Nikki Haley, who we know here in South Africa as the only one who seemed to have any chance of challenging Donald Trump. Does she work full time with you?
Well, people at that level have a lot of different irons in the fire. So she's part of Hudson, I think she does other things as well, of course. So she's, yes, very prominent. We also have Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State during the first Trump administration, the former National Security Advisor during Trump 1 is also with us, his former Attorney General. So it's well-stocked with, as you say, heavy hitters.
And your focus particularly is on Africa. And no doubt considerably on South Africa. Why so?
Well, I lived on the continent in Zambia and Kenya for about 5 years, just over 5 years, I guess. In Zambia, I'd read about South Africa, of course, but it was my time in Zambia that really sparked my interest in the country. We would travel down to South Africa for a vacation. It's a beautiful country. We always had a wonderful time. And then when I lived in Kenya and worked there, I would actually go to South Africa for on a few occasions for work trips, and I think for vacation again. So I've had a personal connection to the country for well over a decade now, and always admired it and really enjoyed it there. So that's where my interest in the country comes from. But as you say, my portfolio is Africa. So that's obviously massive and impossible for any one person to track. So I do end up focusing on certain key countries, certain key regions, and certain key themes. South Africa would be one of those countries.
Sitting in Washington, what exactly are you seeing in this relationship between the US and South Africa right now? Give us American perspective on it.
Yeah, I think it's gotten quite bad. And this goes back even to the Biden administration, actually. I'm sure you remember and your viewers would remember that It was the Biden-appointed ambassador, Ruben Brigati, who first aired publicly some of the concerns that the United States had with the actions of the South African government. And then obviously the concern around the ICJ case against Israel that South Africa brought was also happened during the Biden administration, and the concerns about South Africa's response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine was also started during the Biden administration. So there's a history here to this. I think if I could try to sum up what has happened, I think it's been a confluence of events. The ICJ case and the Ukraine invasion and sort of South Africa's response or role in those things really shocked people in Washington and made them take a new scrutiny or to start scrutinizing South Africa and its actions in a way that had not happened before. Traditionally, the ANC, the party of Nelson Mandela, the party that ended apartheid, it had immense moral cachet and credibility within DC, I think because people didn't scratch the surface much, frankly. And they just sort of assumed that any party that, again, was led by Mandela and had ended or had led the fight against apartheid must, you know, be a moral actor and a responsible actor. But again, the ICJ case and the Ukraine invasion by Russia and South Africa's extraordinarily tepid response to that, I think, alerted people that something else was going on here. And then once people started watching and observing, there were many other things that were highly problematic for the United States. The relationship with Iran, their relationship with Hamas, the public statements that the ANC would make blaming Israel for October 7th, for instance, the public statements that the ANC would make lamenting the loss or the death of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, mourning the loss of the death of heads of Hamas, eulogizing them in a way. These are terrorist organizations in the United States context, and I would argue in any context, but the U.S. considers these to be terrorist organizations. And then there's other grievances I could list. So once people started noticing, once they started scratching the surface, the concerns mounted and mounted and mounted, and then suddenly President Trump came into office again, a president who famously has much less patience for the bad behavior of other countries, behavior that directly and deliberately challenges United States national interests. So I think this is the situation now in Washington.
So if I can maybe paraphrase, and please help me if I'm going wrong here, it's almost as though the ANC had a lot of political capital, and it was South Africa is so small in a global context. We're less than 0.5% of global GDP, so it could get away with lots of stuff without anyone really noticing or taking much interest in it. But that has now all changed. So why would it be that Donald Trump, who's got a heck of a lot on his plate right now, is taking such an interest in this country? People here say, oh, it's Elon Musk, because he was brought up, born and raised in South Africa. And there's other very well positioned South Africans who are in the United States who have Trump's ear. Just help us through understanding why suddenly it matters.
I think it started to matter because the ANC thrust South Africa into the big boy league, let's say. By bringing the case against Israel at the ICJ, they suddenly began playing very aggressively on one side of a high-stakes geopolitical competition. Israel is, this is no surprise, it is one of the United States' very closest allies. It's the only democracy in the Middle East. It's really the only pro-American country in the Middle East. There's a large Jewish population in the United States. It's one of the, sadly, one of the few countries in the world where Jews mostly feel safe. So when South Africa so aggressively inserted itself into this competition, the United States noticed. And then they also inserted themselves a little bit into the Russia-Ukraine issue by leading a quixotic delegation of African heads of state to negotiate peace between Putin and Zelensky. Again, it was quixotic and foolish. But also President Ramaphosa visited separately Moscow separately, where he praised President Putin, called Russia a staunch ally, etc. So you're right. When South Africa was not aggressively inserting itself into these high stakes geopolitical contests, I think the United States was both not noticing, and if it did notice some of the hostility coming out of the ANC, the U.S. could shrug it off. But again, because it suddenly threw its lot in very aggressively, very openly, very publicly, with one side of a highly contentious, highly important geopolitical issue, the United States could no longer ignore what was going on.
Now, there are many in South Africa who've been calling on Washington and asking the U.S. to please intervene, or at least to use some moral suasion against the ANC, which has been driving a Soviet-type philosophy in many respects. Now, suddenly, they're being heard and being called treasonous back home, which is an interesting turn-up for the books. But let's get on to the article that you wrote, which takes a different approach. You propose or suggest that the individuals within the ANC or within South Africa who have accelerated this campaign be brought to book individually. And as I said in the introduction, I saw on a board of directors I served on how quickly that refocused the mind when it is personally involved. Ideology then starts becoming a little less important to the practical implications. Is this part of what your thinking is?
Yes, absolutely. I think my thinking on this is informed a bit by the work I did on South Sudan years ago, when the civil war there broke out between Salva Kiir and Riek Machar. I watched the conflict closely. The United States was trying hard to end that conflict. And they did various things, but it really became obvious to me that guys like Riek and Salva don't really care about broad-based indiscriminate measures. They might care as an abstraction or a little bit, but if you really want them to care and to reconsider their actions, you had to impact them personally. And I think this is a useful frame of analysis for other conflicts. I think it applies to Sudan, for instance. Again, Generals Hameti and Berhan, they've proven they don't particularly care about their own people. They're willing to kill many of them or have them be killed. So it's really about what impacts them personally. And so I think that's why targeted sanctions are the way to go in situations like this. And it also, not only I think is it a more effective approach, but also avoids hurting the wrong people. I don't want collateral damage from what the United States is doing in South Africa, because the ordinary people, they're not the cause of what's going on in the South African government. So it's almost a question of justice as well. I think it's a central component of a true understanding of justice that the people who do the wrong things are the ones who should suffer the consequences as much as possible. We live in an imperfect world, so it's not always how it works out, but I think it's a good guiding precept.
How do you select those people for sanction? And what sanction would you put onto them?
Yeah, so as I wrote in my piece, South Africa is a target-rich environment for American sanctions for a bunch of reasons. One is the United States does have an authority called the Global Magnitsky Sanctions Act, which, or GLOMAG for short, which targets human rights abuses and corruption. So right away, given what we know about ANC corruption, that means GLOMAG would probably apply to any number of ANC officials. And the U.S. itself wouldn't even have to do a whole lot of work to find the right people, because the South Africans have already done a lot of this work with the Zondo Commission, where they named names of highly corrupt senior ANC officials. So I think if you're building a profile of the type of person that the United States should sanction, and I lay this out in my piece, it is a senior person. Sometimes we make the mistake of going after less senior, mid-level people. I think we intend it as a warning, but oftentimes that is received as a lack of seriousness. So you go after senior people to demonstrate your seriousness. You go after people who are corrupt. Again, that's pretty easy. And then given the amount of Hamas, Hezbollah, ISIS funding that flows through or originates in South Africa, it's possible that there are ANC officials linked to that. So that would be another checkbox that would be really useful if you can draw those, if you can discover those links or unearth those links. There's also sanctioned Russian oligarchs operating in South Africa right now. Victor Wexelsberg, who I referenced in the piece, who, it's a matter of public record, has contributed to the ANC. So I think that would be a fairly easy case to build. So that's the and people who have been leading the anti-American charge. There's a couple different people here who immediately spring to mind. So that's the profile that I think the U.S. should go after. And hopefully, if you go after that group of people, and you demonstrate the United States is deadly serious about this, and you demonstrate the extreme impact that targeted sanctions like this can have on somebody's wealth and their ability to move freely, that might focus minds within the ANC. And even beyond the ANC, there's a number of regimes throughout Africa that behave very poorly in all sorts of ways. And maybe that might be a useful lesson for them, that the United States, if you continue to antagonize us, can respond in ways that will make your life demonstrably worse.
I remember researching some time back that the long arm of the U.S. Justice Department reaches pretty much everywhere, because if you do a transaction in dollars, in U.S. dollars, you can be, or if you're an American citizen living somewhere else and you corrupt, you can be taken to task by the U.S. But I was just wondering, let's just say you've got a former cabinet. Take a guy, there's a fellow here called Mark Pamensky, and he worked with the Guptas, and he was instrumental in a lot of corruption at Eskom. He's hardly even being mentioned since the Zondo Commission. What could you do to a lad like this, to a fellow like this, Pamensky? Just use him as an example without knowing the details. Just assume that he is a corrupt individual.
Well, with anyone that you place sanctions on, you cut off their ability to use dollars. Now, that's a much larger problem for people than it might initially appear on the surface. You can say, well, we use Rand, it doesn't matter. Well, right. But any sort of international transaction is going to touch dollars at some point during the transaction. So your international transactions are gone, unless you're doing some sort of direct exchange with in renminbi or something, which is much less common, although it does happen. If you want to use any sort of banking service, including credit cards from an American company, MasterCard, Visa, etc., that's all gone. And then there are other things. There are other ways that this would manifest, that sanctions would manifest, that would be highly unpleasant and inconvenient for anyone who's under such sanctions.
That's interesting. So Visa and MasterCard, which dominate the credit card and debit card market in South Africa, if you decided to put Pamensky onto a list, onto a sanctioned list, he would not be allowed to have a Visa or a MasterCard, even though he would have it through a South African bank?
I believe that's correct. Because the again, if so, if a transaction is converted into dollars, even for a microsecond, then suddenly it comes under the jurisdiction of the United States. So in a case where you are accessing an American company, it's likely, I believe, that the let's say you're using your visa in South Africa in Cape Town or something. I believe that that transaction, even if you're buying a 5 rand, candy or something, that would actually be converted briefly, very briefly, into dollars, and then that's where the vulnerability comes for the person using the visa.
Very inconvenient. But when you take it further and deeper, a lot of the criminals or crooks here, you don't steal R1 trillion plus without having some of it, or probably most of it, invested around the world. Could you track that then? Is it possible then, under, let's just say, you sanction this same fellow and he has got investments in the US, or be a little more obscure, through a Swedish bank into US securities? Would you be able to track those down?
A lot of them, probably, maybe all of them. It's because again, this is very common, as you reference, that corrupt individuals all around the world will seek ways to launder that money, to hide the fact that they have it at all. So you get shell companies and offshore bank accounts and et cetera. So this is a well-known phenomenon, and I'm not an expert on the intricacies of sanctions enforcement. I have friends who are and who work in that space. And I know it does take some investigation, but they are highly adept at this because it's what you have to do if you implement sanctions, because people are going to try to evade those.
Sure. When you take it a little bit further, and once you've sanctioned these individuals, have you got any examples of how they react? In other words, do their attitudes harden, or do they buckle?
Well, it varies. So sanctions are not an end in and of themselves. They need to be part, they're a tool, and they need to be part of a broader strategy that has very clearly articulated goals. And then the sanctions are for shaping actions and shaping behavior. So in that would be the theory of the case here. In other situations, let's say Iran, they are to shape behavior, but they're also to degrade the Iranian regime's ability to develop its ballistic missile capabilities or its nuclear program, for instance. So it has a slightly different focus. So the reactions vary. Obviously, in the Iranian case, they hardened their attitude, but I would already argue it was already a very hard attitude, and that was the whole point of sanctioning them, was we had gotten nowhere with any other efforts. So the best we could do in that situation was to restrict their ability to carry out their nefarious plans. There are other regimes with senior people, including, let's say, in Zimbabwe, who have been under sanctions for years. And there's interesting talk going around that they would really like not to be sanctioned, and that they might potentially be willing, to do what it takes to not be sanctioned. So even if you are trying to sanctions proof yourself, and there are ways to evade sanctions, it requires an immense amount of work. It's extraordinarily difficult and inconvenient. And it may not be foolproof, because the US, with its allies, are always refining their tools, their sanctions tools, and their investigatory abilities. So it's a very perilous undertaking to try to evade American sanctions.
So let's take it to the next level and say that the threat, let's just say that your article, and I'm sure it has been well read in Washington, but it goes to somebody who says, okay, now let's go forward with this. This is a very good idea. How does it get effected? Is there what is the process that would need to be followed before certain South Africans who have been exposed to be corrupt or to be harming in the US's mind, the US interests, that they get put onto such a list?
There are a couple different processes, actually. So Congress can initiate one through GLOMAG that we've already talked about, because that's written right into the statute for GLOMAG. So if Congress wants to take this up, they can initiate a process. A lot of times the process begins in the executive branch. So maybe the White House or the National Security Council or the State Department, somebody will think we need to pursue sanctions. And then there's an entire process that runs through Treasury Department, State Department. Because there are different types of sanctions, you have different agencies that are the lead on the different types of sanctions. So State Department has a chunk of it. Treasury has a chunk of it. And again, I mentioned that Congress can also initiate a process potentially if it chooses, although it has to be specific offices within Congress. It gets pretty complex, but there are a variety of avenues, variety of agencies or offices that could initiate a process.
It sounds to me like you got to be pretty serious to go ahead with this in the first case. And it's almost like it's a big stick, but you don't really want to use it until you absolutely have to. What would you say, given that you took the time to write this piece, what would you say the likelihood is of this being employed, this very big stick being employed against certain South Africans?
You're right. It's not a step the United States wants to take, and certainly not lightly, because it is a lot of work. And because sanctions are so potent, you want to make sure you get them right. It's not something you rush into in a slapdash manner. I would say there is keen interest in pursuing this route in Washington, D.C.
Because there has been no reciprocation, no back channels that have been opened for discussion? In other words, no progress being made?
Right. So I can give you some examples here. The DA had a delegation in D.C. a couple weeks ago, I hosted them at Hudson, and I've hosted ANC officials before, and I'll talk to anybody and everybody. It's useful for me, and I think it's useful for DC audiences to hear from people. And they were there, the DA delegation was there to try to assess what was going on, figure out a way forward to preserve the US-South Africa relationship. And as they were there, President Ramaphosa published a piece in Foreign Policy, a widely read magazine in Washington, D.C., but, well, not just Washington, but doubling down on the anti-Israel, South Africa's anti-Israel position. Remember as well that President Ramaphosa signed the expropriation law. It had sat on his desk for nearly a year. And then he signed it after Trump came into office. Now, I think that likely had more to do with domestic political dynamics in South Africa than with Trump. But at the same time, the ANC is saying it wants to improve relationships. It's concerned. President Ramaphosa made comments like this just a few days ago, and they weren't his only comments. They continue with their provocations, and they continue doubling down. And I think the problem here is that this has been their model for decades that has worked with the United States. We already talked about how the ANC had immense moral cachet in Washington. So even when frictions arose in the relationship, it was all smoothed over quite quickly because they had that immense goodwill within Washington, D.C. I think they still might believe that's what they can do here. They can continue to pursue their anti-American, anti-Western impulses while also having a healthy economic relationship with the United States. I hope that they are not laboring under that illusion, but I fear they may. So, and I don't believe the United States is asking them to cut off any sort of relationship with China or Russia, for instance, because we work with all sorts of countries that have relationships with China and Russia. Practically everyone does. But again, the issue here is how aggressively the South African government has inserted itself into these highly sensitive geopolitical issues. As the former U.S. ambassador to South Africa said, South Africa is not aligned. A genuinely non-aligned stance, I think the United States would recognize and respect that and be okay with it. But that is not the position that the ANC has been pursuing.
Josh, you have been talking to South African delegations, as you've indicated. If the president and the deputy president and a number of other South Africans, senior South Africans from the ANC were to come to you, what would your advice to them be?
I would say they need to first tone down the rhetoric. They also need to make substantive changes. They need to get back to a genuinely non-aligned stance. That does not mean you can't, trade with China or Russia. But you need to stop with the aggressive alignment with American adversaries. There are specific things, right? Probably that they could do within that, but that should be the general framework. Is the United States very clearly sees that the ANC is aligned with American adversaries. So it's totally unsurprising that the United States is upset by that. So the U.S. or the ANC needs to take concrete actions to demonstrate that it is pulling back from openly and aggressively aligning with American adversaries.
Joshua Masovi is the senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.